Freedom Decrypted is sponsored by Think Penguin and Liberty Minded. Streaming live from our Keene, New Hampshire studio, this is your host, Christopher Wade, and joining us remotely is Elstone here. Yeah. And where are you, Elstone?
I'm on the Free Coast. It's Free Coast Day, and there's a group, the Praxium, where they host events. So there's a big party. There was a kickball game earlier. The Free Coast team beat the Quill team. They won by over 7 points. Having a good time. It's a little bit sunny, but I had to take a break to do the show here.
Oh, great. Well, welcome to the show. I know you're starting a little bit late. I don't know who's tuning in now. Because it's way late. Way later than I expected because we had some remote connectivity issues. We actually only have audio as a result. And I don't know, something. We had video at first and then we lost it. So, all right. I don't actually have a lot of stories this week that I brought in. Did you bring anything in interesting, Elstone? I think you said you did on the...
Yeah, definitely a few stories, some cryptocurrency related things. There's a lot of stories from the cryptocurrencies channel with a lot of subscribers, and they share a lot of different stories, a lot of Coin Telegraph stories, some whiskey that was bought using the blockchain for the few stories.
Okay. Do you you have one that you'd be interested in starting off with?
Yeah, we could start on the whiskey story. So this
and I think we just lost him. So maybe
what's that, Chris? Were you trying to say something?
Yeah, this connection seems to be pretty bad.
Is it? Okay.
Yeah, I mean you can keep going and we'll see how it works, but
okay. Well, this is a story by Jeff Telegraph from today, September 12th, 2020. A fund launched in March with the aim of tokenizing up to $20 million worth of whiskey, has announced its first round of a Kentucky bourbon. So Wave Financial Group announced yesterday, September 11, that its Kentucky Whiskey 2020 Digital Fund had bought an initial 1,000 barrels from the Wilderness Trails Distillery. So the story just goes on. I guess it takes 5 to 6 years to age the bourbon, and the value is expected to be $1 per barrel during the period. So there's real world assets such as whiskey, and they're exceptionally difficult, it says, for investors to get exposure to it. The fund manager Benjamin Tsai says, "Our extensive research has shown that the returns from aging Kentucky bourbon are very stable and strong over the circa 5-year period it spends in barrels before being bottled. So we are delighted to be able to provide investors with exposure to this price appreciation." So they expect most investors to hold asset for the full term. The holding will be tokenized in year 2, and it will allow any investor who wishes to exit early to do so, provided they can find a buyer. So they're basically tokenizing barrels of Chris, so that's the first story that I got. And there's a few other stories. I'm not sure if this is still working. Are you?
Yeah, it's working. It's not working great, but it's working good enough, I guess.
Okay, good. Do you want me to continue? You want to discuss that at all? I mean, it's a pretty simple story, just tokenizing the essentially futures in the barrels of whiskey.
Okay. Yeah. Are there any interesting bits you want to cover in the story, or will you say what you want to say? I'm not sure how interested I'm in that particular story. But I also don't really know the details of it. So.
No, that's it. Hopefully it's not, there's been a lot of scams, like crypto investment scams, where the people collecting the money will try and exit out. And a lot of the crypto, I guess the altcoins or shitcoins, are essentially scams for the creators to try and extract as much
Right. So you think this is an exit scam that you're talking about here?
No, I don't think so. It looks, I'm hoping that it's genuine. It looks pretty real. Like, it, apparently they raised the funding, they bought the barrels, and then it says they're planning on sending the tokens to all the investors after apparently like 1 year, in the first or second year after it starts to age, and then they'll be able to trade it. It seems like a pretty simple story. I think it'll work out pretty well.
Cool. It's always interesting to hear about different ways people are using the blockchain. I suspect it's mostly useful for crypto, you know, to use as a medium of exchange, not backed by anything, not dissimilar to the US dollar, though. If you can make it work in other ways, in other places, all the more power to you. All right. Let's see here.
And if you want, we can move on to that IRS $625,000 bounty.
Yeah, let's talk about that. I brought that story in too, actually. So it's probably a good one to get into. You wanna go for it?
I'll let you start if you don't mind. I've got a loaded stuff.
Sure. So I got let's see here. Yep, this is it here. So I got the story from heraldsheets.com. I don't know if that's like the heraldtimes.com, but here we go. U.S. Internal Revenue Services, IRS, will pay $625,000 to whoever cracks Monero's network's privacy wall. So let's see here. Yeah. So, and this isn't, I don't feel like this is the first time or first story that I've heard of a government agency either reporting, a bounty of some kind for cracking cryptocurrencies or privacy friendly cryptos. And I also have heard of, I think we've covered stories on how supposedly somebody has cracked Monero already prior to this, which, you know, there was no basis for it. There was no evidence of it. So it's kind of hard to believe. There is some probable truth to being able to connect if you're sending Monero between exchanges. Sure. I wouldn't be surprised if, you know, they're able to track that. But that's not the same thing as somebody, you know, buying cryptocurrency or buying Monero and then spending Monero somewhere else that isn't going directly to an exchange. Monero only works effectively, and privacy coins only work if you hold those privacy coins yourself. Relying on third parties, well, obviously those third parties then have access to, you know, everything they need. And if you connect those parties together, you know, which the government can do with the centralized exchanges, then you don't have that privacy protection. So, all right, as a report has it, the United States Internal Revenue Services has vowed to pay out up to $625,000 to whoever successfully breaks the privacy wall of Monero network. That is exactly how it's phrased here. It's not me. Monero is widely known as the largest privacy coin in the cryptocurrency ecosystem, according to an official proposal published about a week ago. There's a bounty for anyone that cracks what makes Monero's network untraceable. This proposal also extends to other privacy coins. The proposal reads in part as follows. IRS-CI is seeking a solution with one or more contractors to provide innovative solutions for tracing and attribution of privacy coins, such as expert tools, data source code, algorithms, and other software development services. So you know what's interesting about this is another reason that people shouldn't be utilizing exchanges in order to obtain cryptocurrencies. You want to make it as difficult as possible, you know, for them to trace stuff. And by going through sources that don't demand ID, you are helping to further the anonymity and the difficulty of trying to trace cryptocurrencies and wallets and so forth. But the moment that you connect your wallet to an exchange, there's a name attached to it. So it's no longer, anonymous or private. And it's kind of, whether it's a privacy-friendly crypto or a, you know, something like Bitcoin or Bitcoin Cash, that's a danger. And you really shouldn't be connecting your wallets to exchanges, because when you do, you've attached your name to that wallet effectively. and that will potentially put you at risk. The privacy of Monero, or just using an exchange at all, if the exchange requires some sort of ID or even just a connection to a bank account, potentially. The privacy of Monero. Privacy coins such as Monero allow users to initiate transactions with a high level of privacy. This is made possible by various methods like obfuscating user transaction amounts and addresses of senders and receivers. And like Bitcoin, Ethereum, and others alike, where transaction addresses can be traced back to known wallets and cryptocurrency exchanges. Eventually, the identity of the sender and receiver could be known. IRS further noted that currently there are limited investigative resources for tracing transactions involving privacy cryptocurrencies such as Monero or other off-chain transactions that provide privacy to illicit actors. The terms of IRS about the task. Okay. So I guess they're basically talking about the conditions under which they will give you the money. U.S. Internal Revenue Services is inviting private contractors and individuals to submit the working sample of how they intend to crack the privacy of Monero network. You have to wonder if they're then going to not pay out or I don't know, something, or they already had somebody in mind for this, work, basically. The sample could include, but not limited to, the system designed to provide identifying information of a Monero wallet user, the exact time and date of the transaction, coupled with the exact amount transferred on the Monero network. So that's interesting. So yeah, I mean, presumably if they're linking it to a, you know, like, so basically if somebody got together and, you know, basically got exchanges to cooperate, right? Regulated exchanges might cooperate and provide the identity of the information of the people who are sending the cryptocurrency to an outside wallet. And then they might have, you know, more information. And if you do that, then you could provide this as maybe a service to the IRS. The federal agency is accepting applications until 16th of October. Or September 2020. According to the report, the winner of the contest, interesting, will receive an initial $500,000 payment for developing and proving a working concept of privacy crack tool, and will later receive $125,000 payment after a completed pilot test is approved by the government. You know, I kind of have had the thought of if this is going to work, you know, why would you not just, and this is before I had read the story, but why would you not just take the money yourself? If it's cracked, if Monero is cracked, right? But I get that you don't have to, having read the story now, I get that you don't have to crack it in that way where you could steal it. You could potentially de-anonymize without having the ability to take, you know, the money itself. But certainly if they're looking to crack it in a sense to undermine it, in other words, being able to seize, you know, cryptocurrency from blockchain or whatever, then effectively it would make no sense at all, because if you cracked it in that sense, then you might as well just take, you know, $1 million, which is more than the $625,000 on offer here. So why the IRS is determined to crack privacy coins like Monero. IRS cited instances whereby criminals leverage the privacy of some digital tokens such as Monero to obscure their perpetrations from the public. Okay, well, you have every right to obscure your transactions from the public. Now, they could make a legal argument that you don't have a right to maybe obscure your transactions from the IRS, but, you know, generally you just have to report to the IRS. You know, whether those transactions are obscured or not is irrelevant. IRS noted in April 2020, a ransomware group called Sodinokibi, that future ransom payments will be in Monero rather than Bitcoin due to transaction privacy concerns. So that's the excuse, but I mean, this is the IRS. So why would they care about that? That sounds like they're just providing some sort of justification to gain public support for, you know, what they're doing, when in reality, this is probably, I mean, if this tool really works, it's probably, I would think, going to be used to go after people for tax purposes, not for, you know, illicit activity so much, or at least not the type of illicit activity that they're portraying here. All right. Let's see. What else do we got here? So we really don't actually have that much this week in terms of interesting stories to cover. So or to critique. But here we go. I'll cover what we got, and this may just be a very, very short show. We did a super long show, I think, last week, and now this week we just don't have much content. TorrentFreak.com reports stream rippers, IPTV, and cryptocurrency flagged as growing piracy threats. The latest IP crime and enforcement report published by the UK government signals a wide variety of ongoing and emerging piracy threats. Pirate IPTV services remain a growing problem that could become worse with the rollout of 5G. It reads, a little skeptical of that. So one of the problems that exists with the piracy, you know, situation as it relates to cellular services is that you have very limited bandwidth generally, to watch and to use and to do video kind of stuff with. Even unlimited services are really not that unlimited. You get like so many gigabytes, maybe you'll get 15 gigabytes, but that's not unlimited. I mean, 15 gigabytes is really, really easy, to go over if you're actually using it to watch video and so forth. I remember a few years ago, I had a cellular service temporarily for temporary internet access for my business, and we actually had a bit of a problem because we didn't yet have fiber installed, and so we were using effectively cellular internet access, and we used a hotspot of some kind, and at the time, the problem was, and it still is really, and I think it's only gotten worse since then, actually, we were paying, I think it was about $300 a month in order to, not for video services, we were not doing any kind of video or anything or any kind of big downloads. We avoided that. We avoided like using bandwidth, and we still ended up having to, I think it was like $100 for 10 gigs or something at the time. So it ended up being like we used like 30 gigabytes of data roughly a month, and it ended up coming to like $300, $300 bill. And we did that for 2-3 months while we waited for a fiber line to be installed. So I guess we could probably have gone with like maybe ADSL or cable temporarily, and they were suggesting a wireless link, but it seemed like it wouldn't be worthwhile to go that route. I thought we could sustain the business off of a cellular connection, and we did, but it did not work well at all. We had to we had some hacks to get VoIP working over for our phone systems, working over a VPN effectively, and the connection was just terrible, as one might expect with latency issues probably, and as well as just connectivity issues in general. And then there was actually another issue that I didn't fully appreciate or realize at the time, was that the building was actually the cellular signal was very weak because the building has, I think it's aluminum siding or something that interferes with reception. So we're probably, I don't know if the reception is weak out immediately outside, but it's certainly not super strong. And then you go inside a building where there's building materials that are hindering the reception, and just the whole situation, adding it up and then adding VPN to it and all that, is just not a good combination. But nonetheless, we did survive. We did manage to download like an ISO once in a while, to keep business going and so forth. But we didn't download a whole lot of ISOs, mind you, but every once in a while we would download an ISO. GNU Linux and whatnot, ISOs type deal. So let's see here, where were we? Back to the story here. It reads, there are also concerns about the use of cryptocurrencies and the growth of stream rippers. Yeah, the cryptocurrency thing is kind of an interesting aspect of this, because if we've looked at other stories, I think we've looked at other stories, I've read other stories anyway, and the cryptocurrencies are like a very, very little. Cryptocurrencies are going to like very, very big sources like the Pirate Bay. I think they received like less than a couple $1,000 for the cryptocurrency last year. So kind of, you know, begs the question, or at least of Bitcoin, kind of makes you wonder how much cryptocurrency is really a threat right now. I could see it being a potential threat, but, you know, we need way more people on board with cryptocurrencies. And I'm constantly advocating, you know, and helping people get set up with cryptocurrency and getting new businesses on board. And New Hampshire is, you know, one of the best places to be for that, because there's actual real world usage here and a lot of supporters because of the migration movement of people who support freedom. The general freedom migration movement, I'll call it, but that includes, you know, groups like the Free State Project and the Shire Society and so on, and then like dozens of, you know, smaller groups throughout mostly southern New Hampshire, but there's actually a growing number of people in northern New Hampshire as well. Northern New Hampshire is just cold though, so not probably a good idea to move up there, and there's not a lot of people or jobs up there, but yeah, hey, each his own. If you want to kind of live in the middle of nowhere, New Hampshire is already, you know, not exactly, yeah, I mean, it's if you live in like Nashua or Manchester, it's like maybe an hour from Boston. So it's not like it's in the middle. It's two in the middle of nowhere, depending on where you live. But there's certainly, you know, if you go, you know, if you go north of southern New Hampshire, you do start to get in the middle of nowhere for real. And even in Keene, New Hampshire, it's a bit in the middle of nowhere. Boston is about 2 hours from here, but there is Manchester, which is an hour. There's Nashua, that's an hour. There is Portsmouth is 2 hours. Concord is an hour. We're basically everybody in southern New Hampshire is about an hour, and two at the absolute most from basically like 95% of the population in New Hampshire. So it's kind of a good, whether you want more city life or you are more of a rural person, pretty much anywhere in New Hampshire is, you know, or I shouldn't say anywhere in New Hampshire, but there is some place in New Hampshire for you. And southern New Hampshire has lots of jobs. There's actually, New Hampshire is one of the states with the lowest unemployment rates. And the cost of living, the wages versus the cost of living are excellent. So, it's also one of the freer states already. It's not a free state because that doesn't exist anywhere in the world. But if you're looking for freedom, it's definitely a good place to go, and that's one of the reasons why cryptocurrencies have flourished in New Hampshire, where they've kind of fizzled out elsewhere in the world. Now, it's not to say that it's not growing to some degree in the just general, like, you know, on the internet and, you know, on the dark web and so forth, but one of the bigger and a few cities around the world it's growing too, but it's definitely concentrated cryptocurrency acceptance to certain areas of the planet, and two of the biggest places are Keene, New Hampshire, and Portsmouth, New Hampshire, where each town or very small city has dozens of retail businesses accepting crypto. It's not so much there's lots of other people and businesses accepting crypto, but I'm just strictly talking about the retail businesses. So if you want to hire a guy to come in, I don't know, clean your house or mow your lawn, you can also, you know, find people who will take crypto and do those things as well. But that's not what I would call retail. Retail would be like a restaurant or, you know, a brick and mortar store that sells computers or whatever. An online retailer, not counting that. Think Penguins operated at Keene, New Hampshire, but we don't. You know, I wouldn't count Think Penguin because we don't have a brick and mortar retail store that, you know, people can come into to pick stuff up. Maybe at some point, we'll open something. I do have a connection to a new business called, convenience store, Money Moose Marts. And that's right next to the Bitcoin Embassy. Which maybe I would think about doing something there. The problem with a computer store, effectively, you know, selling Linux, is that most of your customers are spread out around the world. So even though there's actually quite a few, there's quite a few customers like in New Hampshire, but like as a percentage of the business, it doesn't really make sense to set up a brick and mortar store, because effectively you have you'll end up with increased costs. Warehouse space is much cheaper than retail space. So if we were to do something, it more likely would be a wall, you know, a wall with computer parts and things like that and accessories than, you know, in maybe, I don't know, the Bitcoin Embassy or something like that, then, you know, we would actually set up a full store for, and maybe there would be a couple computers there or something that you can come check out too, but it wouldn't make sense to set up, it's not to say it doesn't make sense to set up a computer shop to sell computers locally. You could do that, but your advertising is going to be, your whole business model is going to be different. And I've actually done this. So it's not to say that you couldn't do it. It would work. I saw it work. But the way you would do something like that is you would set up a computer repair type of operation, and then you'd market that, and then you'd gain customers, and then you could sell, you know, your Linux whatever, computers and accessories and GNU stuff to those customers. That works very well, actually. You've got you probably would have as much of an 80% conversion rate from just general people running whatever, like Windows or Mac, to Linux. But at the time that I was doing it, it was really closer to 50%. So, but that was good for, you know, five, 10 years ago. Now, though, with some of the biggest obstacles to moving people who have never touched Linux before to Linux are, just generally speaking, was actually QuickBooks. So we could get another 30% of those customers back in the day when I was doing something like this, were stuck on Windows. Like, I couldn't move them. Like, I couldn't sell them a computer with Linux because it just wasn't going to work for them. They couldn't use QuickBooks, and I couldn't make it work. I couldn't even get it to work in Wine. QuickBooks now is discontinued their software, basically, and they've moved it to an online service, so that isn't an issue anymore, and that online service should work with GNU Linux without a problem. So I would say probably about 80% of the population, you know, it's certainly enough to basically set up a computer store that sells Linux computers anywhere in the world, I think. I think it's funny that people are like, well, how can you make that work? Well, you actually can make that work, because I did make that work. Now, it wasn't at the time exclusively Linux, but I think today you probably could make it work. But again, you know, we're so focused on worldwide, you know, catering to people worldwide, that it doesn't make sense for Think Penguin to necessarily do it. It would just be another workload that it just doesn't make sense. We've already got enough on our shoulders that it wouldn't make sense to try and spend time and energy and resources on that project. Maybe to some degree it would, but not a full store, you know, that's all that store did. It would be more like a, you know, selling electronics in another store, somebody else's store. It would be more like that. That we could probably, you know, pull off with relative ease, given enough time, given enough energy was put into. We're already actually changing our packaging, so it's more retail friendly with proper. We have SKUs and we have model numbers, but proper barcodes and things of that nature, so that they will scan in at retail. And this is actually more than most places have, as far as like Amazon, I've noticed, and other sources that you go to, you'll frequently find that they actually don't have, maybe they have an ASIN number, but they don't have an actual barcode that will be recognizable by, you know, a typical retail store. So, all right, let's go back to our story. And I went off on a tangent again. All right, and the growth of stream rippers. Last week, the UK government's intellectual property office published its annual IP crime and enforcement report. The report provides an overview of the latest anti-piracy achievements of copyright holders and also signals emerging threats. Like every year, the general consensus is that piracy and counterfeiting remain a problem. However, specifics and priorities change over time. When the first report was published 15 years ago, P2P file sharing was the top concern. Today, this is a relatively small part of the piracy landscape. The 120-page report covers a wide range of IP crimes, but we will zoom in on some of the top piracy-related threats and responses as reported by the Federation Against Copyright Theft and police intellectual property crime unit. It drives me nuts every time I hear or I read the words theft. That's not theft. A copy of something, I understand, you know, you may have some sort of argument, you know, legitimate or maybe illegitimate, whatever, some sort of sound argument, you know, for copyright, but that doesn't make it theft. And to call it theft is really misleading, because it implies that you're depriving somebody of something that's theirs, and copying it does not deprive anybody of anything. It at most gives you something, but if you steal a CD from a store, the store loses that CD. They can't now sell that CD to somebody else. If you copy a CD in that store and then they sell that CD to somebody else, they've not lost anything. And so it's not theft, it's copyright infringement. And whether or not copyright infringement is a good thing or a bad thing, well, I'm going to say it's a bad thing because that's my opinion on it. But you know, that's a different argument. And this manipulation of people's, you know, perspective on this, that's what this is. That's what it is when you call something theft. That's not theft. They are trying to, you know, affect you emotionally. They're trying to give you, you know, I'm against theft, but I'm not against, you know, copyright infringement, because it's not theft. It's manipulation is what it is. And really, it's in no other industry, almost anyway, do we permit monopolies. But that's what copyright is. It's a monopoly over the distribution of the content. And that there's something wrong with that. Any other industry, you know, you'd be looking to break up those businesses. But in the copyright, you know, cartel world, you know, they have a legal monopoly. They've literally convinced people that they are producing content for your good, for your benefit. That was the whole excuse behind copyright. It was supposed to be a limited time monopoly for the benefit of the public. After a 7-year period, that copyright was supposed to go into what they call the public domain. And it that's not how it works today. Copyright doesn't go into the public domain. It's just that's not how the system works. They extended it from 7 years to 20 years to 50 years to basically 100 years, but really it's indefinite, because effectively it's like 100 years. I don't even remember what the details are, but it's something absolutely ridiculous, like 100 years plus the life of the creator or something like that, unless it's a corporation, and then it becomes 170 years or something. And so effectively something that's produced today, you will never have access to via the public domain, you know, that's copyrighted today, unless it's explicitly put into the public domain by the, you know, creators effectively. There's even an issue. And it even gets worse, because there's even a potential issue with copyright affecting free software, because if you assign a copyright, the copyright, I think it goes back to the person who wrote the code or something, and it's effectively it was intended to resolve an issue where basically I think it was the musicians didn't get a good deal when they signed on with the music industry, or I'm trying to think what those people are called, publishers, not publishers, the record companies, I guess. So back in the day, and so they got a bad deal basically, and so they came and they were like, all right, well, we're gonna return the copyright to the author after a certain period of time, like 20 or 30 years or whatever it is. And the thing is, it's like, you shouldn't be able to live indefinitely off of one freaking album that you created, or song, or whatever it is. And yet that's this perception, and people like go into the music business not for the right reasons. They're going in, and it's not that it's bad to try and make money off your work or your creativity. I think that's a great thing. That's not it, but they're going in with this expectation, you know, that they're gonna be filthy rich, and then they don't, and then they're like, well, I need copyright in order to make a living. And it's like, well, first of all, no, you don't. It doesn't even work, and it's not benefiting you. It's benefiting mostly, you know, mega corporations in the record industry. It's not benefiting you. And most of the money that's made by most musicians is through concerts and other avenues. It has nothing to do with copyright or the record industry. So it's mostly hurting the public. It's mostly hurting musicians, and yet they have deceived, you know, both you know, people in that field in the creative industries, as well as the public, into this idea, you know, that copyright somehow benefits, you know, musicians, or it would benefit musicians or the public or something. And it's just not reality. That's not how it is. That's not what it's turned into. And I'm skeptical that it ever was intended that way. But you know, they went from a point where there was nothing, and then there was something. And this is frequently how industries get created. It's through legislation rather than through, you know, free market competition. And it should have been created through free market competition, the publishing industry. And it's, unfortunately, it's not how things are today. There was back way hundreds of years ago, there was this idea that they weren't sure that a newspaper could exist. And I mean, mind you, Philadelphia was much smaller back in those days. But it did, and it was successful, and it did work. And it would, you don't necessarily need copyright in order to make these things work. You need a business model, and the industry has become so reliant on copyright, I guess, for their business model, that they don't understand how to compete. And it's like, you could actually make money, and maybe even more money, and be more successful if you actually did things that were saner, rather than try to use violence to achieve your financial objectives, via the use of the state and so on. All right. Let's see here. What else do we got? The growing IPTV piracy problem to begin fact highlights that the number of IPTV piracy complaints increased sharply over the past few years. In 2014, there were just 3 complaints, but by last year, this number had grown to 682. Over the past 6 years, FACT has seen a steady year-on-year increase in public complaints regarding suppliers of illegal IPTV services, the group notes, showing that its intel on these IPTV services has grown as well. As a result of this development, FACT's enforcement efforts are prioritized on IPTV piracy. This has resulted in very successes, including Operation Saturn, where several people associated with IPTV services stopped their activities after a visit from FACT investigators. Blah blah blah. London is, done. They're basically in the hands of the IP, intellectual property owners, which is also a fallacy. It's not property, it's imaginary, is what it is. It's there's no such thing as intellectual property. It's just another, word choice that they've used to attempt to manipulate people into whatever. Let's see here. Blah blah blah. So now they're afraid of 5G, presumably because it's going to provide broadband speeds, which it maybe will be faster, but the last I checked, 5G was even slower than 4G in some cases. Now, presumably, that is the potential for 5G to be faster than 4G, and it probably is. I think it is in Europe and some other places, but in the United States, at least one provider, the 4G was faster than the 5G, and I forget which one it was. But we may have covered that story last week. The Pirate Bay, for example, started accepting Bitcoin donations many years ago, and various pirate services have a cryptocurrency payment option, but it doesn't actually provide sufficient revenue. And it's kind of funny, because people might say, well, see, system of donations doesn't work. Well, that's not really true. The problem with the Pirate Bay and accepting cryptocurrencies is most people don't have cryptocurrency. So it's not a surprise that they're not gaining most of their revenue through cryptocurrency. Now, as cryptocurrency spreads, they're probably going to see an increase in, you know, people donating with cryptocurrency. But until that happens, you know, it doesn't work. I dream of the day that cryptocurrency is widely used. And don't get me wrong, like, we actually get cryptocurrency Think Penguin all the time. You know, we get payment for orders all the time with cryptocurrency. But it's not relative as a number, as a percentage of the overall sales, it's still relatively small. It's just the reality of the world. We actually probably get paid by people. Like, occasionally I'll have people who, like, locally they'll want something, and so, you know, they'll buy something and they'll just pay me in cryptocurrency. And it's like, there's probably as much of that going on as there are sales worldwide in terms of cryptocurrency. But keep in mind that cryptocurrency locally is much more significant than it is, you know, worldwide. So I wouldn't expect there to be anywhere near as many sales worldwide as there are locally. And this is despite the fact that we don't even have a retail store, for people to buy stuff. It's usually, it'll be like, oh, somebody, you know, I'm very well known locally. So, I'll bump into somebody and they'll be like, oh, I want to buy a computer, or they'll call us up and they need a hard drive or they need whatever. And so it ends up being that, you know, I'll physically pass something off to somebody, which is kind of funny. Or I'll, you know, maybe there's an event going on, so I'll bring something to an event. And I go to lots and lots and lots of events, probably at least 3 minimally every week. So there's lots of opportunities for people to interact with me and just be like, and they know, everybody knows me as the Penguin guy. So it's like, you know, they're like, oh, hey, do you have what's this or that? And they're like, oh, hey, can you bring that to this crypto meetup, or, you know, can you bring that to the FreeCoast Festival, or can you bring that to ForkFest, or can you bring that to Social Sunday, or can you bring that to the Nightcap, or can you bring that to Gun Church? I haven't actually been to Gun Church, but yes, Gun Church is a real thing. It's a event that happens, I think, once a month, or maybe it's every week, where people basically get together and they shoot guns and they learn to shoot guns and they learn about, you know, ammo and all that good stuff. And, it's something that probably more people should know how to shoot. I'm not one of those people, but, I should become one of those people. And, maybe at some point I will learn to shoot, but right now I don't. So in the most recent IP crime and enforcement report, cryptocurrencies receive several noteworthy mentions nonetheless. The report highlights these financial mechanisms as part of sophisticated business models that are used by copyright infringers. According to PIPCA, the police are keeping, it just sounds so creepy, PIPCA, like, are you peeping on people? According to PIPCA, the police are keeping a close eye on these crypto transactions, which they signal as a threat that will get worse over time. Payment using cryptocurrencies has now been a feature of PIPCA investigations. It is predicted that payment by cryptocurrency will be an increasing threat due to the level of anonymity cryptocurrencies provide, the report reads. Yeah, I mean, I can see it being used as a means of anonymity. So you might have a bank account set up in somebody else's name. You take in dollars and then you buy cryptocurrency with it, and then you send yourself anonymously, using Monero cryptocurrency to yourself, and that creates a wall, an impenetrable wall that, you know, investigators, you know, can't identify the real source. Or not the source. Well, source. I don't know if source is the right word, but the real perpetrators of, you know, the criminal activity. And in this case, you know, it probably would work pretty well, because, I mean, you know, if you use all the right tools and you're anonymous, and the, you know, you have somebody else. There's something called a mule and in criminal activities. And, you know, the people at the top, they use mules to achieve their objectives and create some level of anonymity. And in the case of this type of crime, you never even have to interact with the mule. So there's no mule to identify you as the ringleader or whatever, however they're going to phrase it. You know, the police or whoever is investigating law enforcement will, you know, I don't know how they'll phrase it, but whatever terms they decide to use. Which include YouTube rippers, rely on advertising as a prime source of revenue, but cryptocurrencies are up and coming. Donations by cryptocurrencies have been observed for the first time as a revenue source for 3% of stream ripping services. Interesting. That's not 3%, but it's I believe that's 3% of the stream ripping services accepting cryptocurrencies. But yeah, I mean, that's great that they're accepting cryptocurrencies, but of those 3%, how much cryptocurrency are they actually getting? And it's probably fairly tiny, considering we've seen the numbers for the Pirate Bay, and it's not that much. And even if, like, and I don't think we know all the numbers for the Pirate Bay. I think it was just like Bitcoin, and it could be that Bitcoin, you know, Bitcoin isn't used as a cryptocurrency really these days. It's kind of died because of the fees involved, but like Bitcoin Cash and other cryptocurrencies have taken off. So there is way more Bitcoin Cash spending going on in the real world than there is Bitcoin spending. It's not to say it's gone away entirely, but the real world is Bitcoin isn't being used to buy stuff anymore. It's Bitcoin Cash, it's Dash, it's other Monero, it's other cryptocurrency that don't have these ridiculous fees, or high fees anyway. You know, in the transaction process. And I know people are going to say, yeah, but there's almost nobody using Bitcoin Cash. Well, that might be, but of the people who are actually using it as a cryptocurrency, almost everybody is using something that's not Bitcoin in order to do transactions. So you can't really look at Bitcoin. And if you want to start looking, if you want to start seeing what's really happening in the cryptocurrency world, as far as, you know, cryptocurrencies that are actually being used for real transactions, what you got to look at probably is AnyPay and BitPay, because those are the providers who effectively, that's how all cryptocurrency currently is being accepted. So maybe coinpayments.net as well. But basically, you take those three providers and say, okay, well, what are people using on or through your platforms? What are most people paying with? And I can guarantee you, and I already know, it's mostly, in at least with AnyPay, it's almost exclusively Bitcoin Cash and a little bit of Dash. Dash was bigger, you know, a little while back, but Bitcoin Cash has really taken over. And so that's what people are using. It's not, you know, yes, there's more activity for Bitcoin than Bitcoin Cash and Dash, but that's most of that's trading. That's not actually people using it as a currency, as a real currency to buy and sell goods with. So, and I'm not a Bitcoin Cash person. Like I'm not a fan, a Bitcoin Cash fan or a Dash fan, or I'm more of a Monero fan. I'm more of a Zcash fan. I like more privacy friendly cryptocurrencies, and those aren't them. But what do I have? I have Bitcoin Cash. I have Dash. That's what people are accepting. That's what the tools that we currently have to accept cryptocurrencies are supporting. And I hope at some point, you know, the systems improve and they will enable people to take Monero more easily. I'm hoping that we'll eventually have a better decentralized means of taking cryptocurrency, so we're not relying on, you know, providers. Right now, providers are the key weak points as far as businesses is taking crypto and governments being able to control and manipulate that, and exchanges. So in time, you know, you don't really need exchanges. When everybody's using cryptocurrency, they're accepting cryptocurrency and they're spending cryptocurrency, you don't need to exchange your dollars for cryptocurrency, because you didn't get dollars when you sold a good, you got cryptocurrency. And I'm already seeing that personally, but it's something that's harder, you know, for a lot of people to fathom. You know, they think about, you know, well, it's going to cost me, you know, 8% to acquire crypto. And that's true, maybe, but, or maybe 0.5%, depending on if you go through an exchange. But the point is simply that that's not always going to be a cost that's there. That's entirely dependent on how you get it. If you are accepting cryptocurrency, you don't have that cost. And the cost of like sending it is for like Bitcoin Cash and Dash and Monero, those fees are insignificant. You know, you're talking about probably a penny maybe, if that, to send a transaction. Whereas Bitcoin might be, yeah, it's fluctuated a lot, but a big part of that has been the result of its failure to adapt as a cryptocurrency to changes in demand. So as demand went up, they didn't increase the block size, and I'm not necessarily a big fan of increasing the block size, but the reality is that was what needed to be done in order to compensate and to still remain relevant as a cryptocurrency. Again, not saying that, you know, it's useless. I still take Bitcoin, I still spend Bitcoin, but it's certainly a lot less relevant to people who are actually wanting freedom, and they want to have control over their finances and their money and so on. And it's not something that dollars or banks will give you or exchanges will give you. So, all right, what else is there? Is there anything specific? I think the crypto was the main thing I was actually interested in this story. So I'm gonna go ahead and we're gonna call that story done. I think we're gonna take a break, and we'll be back after these brief messages.
We'd like to invite you to visit freekeen.com. Freekeen.com features audio, video, and blogs chronicling the transition to a voluntary society. Freekeen.com also has comments and discussion forums so you can be heard. Freekeen.com.
I should be in Keene, New Hampshire with the Free Staters.
If you haven't shopped at libertyminded.com, you're missing out. The company's got lots of great t-shirts, such as voting outside of a two-party system is a wasted vote because the candidate will not win, because voting outside of the two-party system is a wasted vote because the candidate will not win, because voting outside, I think you get the idea. Talk about circular reasoning. Did you know that Fedora the Explorer, exploring free software one distro at a time, is one of my favorite t-shirts? It's a great t-shirt for any distro hoppers in your life. Liberty Minded has lots of great t-shirts like this and many others. How about, I was reported to the FBI, but they just ignored it? Or, no, you can't be my friend. I'm not on Facebook. Which may or may not really be related. Now this is one that all hackers can agree on. Intellectual property is really information slavery. Information just wants to be free. And if the last one was too wordy, how about intellectual property is neither? Join liberty-minded voluntarists, anarchists, and libertarians this summer from June 13th until June 18th for ForkFest 2019 at Rogers Campground in the beautiful White Mountains of New Hampshire. ForkFest happens right before the Porcupine Freedom Festival, and ForkFest is decentralized, which means no one is in charge. That also means there's no ticket cost. Just reserve your camping or RV site or motel room with Rogers Campground for June 13th through June 18th. You can simply relax and go camping with other liberty lovers, or you can create whatever experience or event you'd like others to have. If you're planning an event for ForkFest, be sure to let others know in advance. You can connect with other ForkFesters via the unofficial Telegram chat or the ForkFest forum. Links to those are on the unofficial website, forkfest.party. Check out forkfest.party.
I want to talk to you about privacy online and what you can do to protect yourself. Now, you might be thinking it's too hard. Well, not any longer. With our privacy-friendly Penguin VPN service, it's easier than ever to get a baseline of protection. We have guides for many All right, so apparently the break is over early because I forget what shortcut key does it, but I sometimes mess it up and I don't mess it up. I got to figure out how to make it so my keyboard doesn't actually do things when we're on break. I can do something else. All right. Slight possibility we may have somebody joining us on the show that is not Elstone. I just posted a link to the Freedom Decrypted Telegram group. If you're not on Freedom Decrypted, in the Freedom Decrypted Telegram group channel, or a room or whatever it's called on Telegram, you can join it. Check out freedomdecrypted.com. There is a conversation going on about our phone lines and phone lines not actually being operational. And yeah, they haven't been since like the beginning of the show, started like a year ago or more. Well, it's actually 2 years now. But anyway, we do actually have a Jitsi Meet channel currently at the moment. This live broadcast is, if you were to join the link that I just posted in the Freedom Decrypted channel, you can potentially come on. I will try to bring somebody on if they join. I don't know if it's gonna work. It wasn't working very well with El Stone. He's now off because his internet connection is not very good. It worked well enough at least once previously, so I'm pretty sure it's just his internet connection. I think he's trying to, you know, co-host effectively, which doesn't really work that well. It works better, you know, for an interview, but I think it works better for like call-in than it does for like trying to actually co-host a show with somebody. So I'm not really a big fan of co-hosting and having a co-host remotely. It just doesn't work that well. But I do think it'll probably work well enough if you're on a decent internet connection and want to drop in and give an opinion on a story or bring up any other technical freedom related stories that you're interested in. It was one of the things I did always want to have on the show, but our setup is, there are certain limitations in our setup and just different types of problems that you can run into. And even if it works for a year and a half perfectly fine, you'll for whatever reason, this stuff is always kind of finicky. So it's and it doesn't matter your setup. There's people way, way more experienced with this type of setup and co-hosting, or not co-hosting, but podcasting, I guess, or radio shows than me, and even they have problems. So, and they're not doing it, you know, they've got fancy fancy systems and people to screen calls and all sorts of stuff, way, way better than anything we've got. And this actually is a fairly fancy studio. I don't know if I can bring it up here. I guess not. Okay, so there's a two camera setup at the moment, and I know what it is, but one of my camera video feeds for some reason isn't working, and the inputs on this video mixer that I've got, and but usually I can flip between the different feeds and video feeds, and so one of them right now, if I go over here, is Jitsi. So that's if you were to join there, I could flip it over and have a conversation with you. And my other feed, this one is just black for some reason. The camera is, I'm pretty sure, working. I'm pretty sure it has something to do with the video mixer. But for some reason, the video input on my second input is just not working that well. So I don't know. I tried turning it off, trying to turn it back on, tried to get it working again, but it just kind of, I don't know, I've never had that problem before with it, but so I'm not sure exactly what's going on with it. But I don't know if it's a problem with the, I really don't know why. I don't know what the problem is. I really like this video mixer. So it's actually a I know this is not something that we usually talk about on the show, but it's a AV streaming mixer. It's called it's from Roland, the VR-1HD. And I don't know if there's a better video mixer out there. I've noticed that there's some other video mixers on the market, but this is like, it's probably a good $1,500 to $2,000 mixer, and it's got basically like two audio inputs, microphone inputs, which is kind of a limitation if you want to hook up a phone line or something like that to it. I have another audio only mixer, and maybe I could use them together, but then it gets even more complicated. So it has more inputs. I think that one has four audio inputs for that one, whereas this only has two. So if I want to hook up a external source for people to call in or put a video feed on, it gets complicated because it ends up being at least the video part of it gets complicated. I can probably do some sort of splitter to probably put in like two feeds or hook up the audio mixer to this, but it's just, the whole thing just gets so complicated, and it's like, it's one of these things where it's like, if this was like a real professional show, and it's somewhat professional, it just crummily done. It's kind of crappy the way it's been done, because it's, you know, not putting tons of money or energy into it. It's just enough to be, I don't know, I think put it on as an interesting show as I can. But, you know, if we really wanted to do it, you know, well and right, and throw a bunch of money at it, I'm sure a lot of the issues, you know, could be resolved. You know, it's like it just kind of like, when I have time, I'll try and fix this, or I'll try and fix that, and I'll try and get it working, and I'll try. And then I don't want to touch it, because if I touch it and something stops working, then you end up with problems like we have today, where I tried to set up the remote stuff again and then it stopped working. And it's like, it was working fine. If we just do in studio only co-hosting, don't have a problem. And we can go on for years like that without a problem. But the second you start messing around with stuff, even though I'm pretty knowledgeable about how this mixer works at this point, and it's not that super complicated, it's still complicated enough where problems arise. So, and this is not specific to this video mixer. It's, you know, I had issues with the audio mixer as well, trying to figure out how to make that work. And it's not that there's a technical problem. It's just, it's complicated. And I'm not an audio expert. I'm not a video expert. I don't know, you know, I don't know how to make all this stuff work. I know how, like I know there's lots of podcasts and YouTube videos, you know, people who do it more professionally than I do, that have all sorts of stuff on their screen and whatnot. And I can do that too. It takes a little bit of time and effort to add that stuff, but I don't, because it's like, I'm not that, maybe someday, you know, it's one of those things where it's just like, you could, but what are people really interested in? Do they really care whether or not it shows how many listeners are tuned in? I don't. Does it really matter whether or not we have somebody calling into the show? Probably not that many people are going to be calling in anyway. You know, once you get, even when you have a nationally, which by the way, I co-host a nationally syndicated radio show called Free Talk Live on Fridays from 8 to 10, and even with that show, with 200 radio stations, you really don't get people. I mean, people call in, but it's not like the phone lines are constantly you know, inundated with phone calls. Often there's nobody waiting on the line to that you could even put on, even if you wanted to. So it's most likely, even if you could, and look, even right now, even though I know there's people watching the show right now live, right, there's at least a handful of people, it sounds like, even despite that, even with a handful of people, even having mentioned that people can actually call in right now, you know, not just the phone lines aren't working, but if you get on the Jitsi, even though I've mentioned that, is there anybody showing up in the room? No. And for whatever reason, people just, I don't know, they just don't want to talk, or they don't, I don't know. I don't know what it is, but most of the time, you know, people just, they're just not going to call in. So why would I spend the time and energy to, you know, I mean, maybe at some point, but not like, I'm not going to make it a priority on my priority list of things to do. There's a lot of other things on that priority list, like redoing our break with the advertisements. Oh my God, is that awful? That's cringeworthy, and it needs to be redone. I mean, we've got it. We're promoting the wrong dates for Forkfest from 2 years ago. We've got an ad for Liberty Minded that's just God awful. Great idea. Couldn't make it work. I actually edited that too, so it's not as bad as it originally was, but it's bad. And part of that is because I'm not an expert. I don't know how to make all the audio stuff work, and I didn't use these mics, and the one with the advertisement with the little webcam, or not webcams, the little routers, that came out much better, because it was using the equipment that I'm familiar with. I know how to make work. And so it's more of like a radio ad. And so that one actually comes out okay. The other one where I tried to actually introduce a video component where I'm standing and there's not a mic in front of my face. Not very good. Cringeworthy. All right. Let's get back to actually covering the story here. And I've got a telegram up. That's annoying. Okay. ZDNet.com reports Chilean bank shuts down all branches following a ransomware attack. So normally, I don't think this is that particularly interesting of a story. This happens all the time. Like, And people are like, well, put your money in the bank because it's going to be safe in the bank. And it's like, no, not really. I mean, you know, it's like, it's one of these things that, you know, people just don't really understand. Their money is not that safe in banks. I mean, it may be slightly safer than, you know, under your bed, but it's like, well, and people always give this idea that it's like, okay, if you put the money under the bed and the house burns down, the money is gone, right? Well, it may or may not be. So it kind of depends on various factors. And how many people do you know who've had houses burned down? I can't think of a single person I have ever known that had their house burned down. The only incident I can even recall of somebody's house burning down where it was a situation where somebody in my grade school, not class, but somebody in the same grade as me, maybe not even in the same grade as me, in my elementary school, they had their house burned down. Now, I'll say that the elementary school wasn't that big. I mean, there were probably like, I don't know, a couple thousand students to 5,000 at most. But the point is, like, it just doesn't happen that often. So, you know, how dangerous is it to keep cash in your house? It's probably not that dangerous if you're living in a fairly safe area. You know, how dangerous is it, you know, to store your money in the bank? Well, can't say I've ever had any major issues, but I have had issues with, you know, fraud constantly. Everybody has, you know, with money being, you know, charged to your debit card or whatever. And then you have to fight it and back and forth and, you know, spend time on it. Sometimes you have to go to the police department and file a police report before they'll release your, you know, funds or credit you back or whatever. And so certainly is it safe? I mean, it's relative, might be relatively safe, but I also know people who've had their money stolen from them by governments, you know, bank accounts seized and banks doing the seizing and not releasing the funds. Yeah, you think it only is the government, but it's not. It's actually, I actually know people who have had funds that were seized by banks, and in order to get those funds back, they had to threaten or bring lawsuits against the banks. So it's not as safe as you think. And I'm not talking about small amounts of money either. I mean, I'm talking about, you know, $100,000, you know, amounts of money, or $70,000 amounts of money, maybe, that were seized, or maybe even more than that. I can't recall exactly what the numbers are, but they were not, it wasn't like a typical person's bank account where they had maybe $5,000 in it or something like that. It was more substantial than that. So, all right, let's see here. One of Chile's three biggest banks was forced to shut down all branches on Monday following a ransomware attack that took place over the weekend. Our branches will not be operational and will remain closed today, the bank said in a statement published on its Twitter account on Monday. Details about the attack have not been made public, but a source close to the investigation told ZDNet that the bank's internal network was infected with Revil ransomware. The incident is currently being investigated as having originated from a malicious Office document received and opened by an employee. Yeah, and the other thing is, like, banks, you know, even when you have effectively money stolen from your account and the bank reimburses you, okay, so people have to remember that there are fees associated to cover those losses. So you might not be losing the money immediately, but you're paying for those losses through those fees. So you end up losing money by storing it in a bank account. Chances are, if you stored it under your bed, you're probably not going to see those losses. I mean, it could happen. Somebody could break in, but chances are you're going to be paying way more in fees than anything that you might lose if you just stashed it under your bed. I mean, okay, maybe someday somebody breaks in your house and they steal the couple grand that you have under your bed, right? Over the course of a lifetime, how much are you paying in fees? You're probably paying more than a couple grand in fees. So I suspect for most people, it's probably not as dangerous to store cash under your bed than it is to, you know, store it in a bank account. Let's see here. Hackers used the backdoor to access the bank's network and install ransomware. Bank employees working weekend shifts discovered the attack when they couldn't access their work files on Saturday. But yeah, this is mostly in respect of, you know, cryptocurrency, you know, and people saying you wouldn't store cash under your bed and then relating that to cryptocurrency, why would you store cryptocurrency on your phone and or your computer? And it's like, well, because the banks aren't really that safe either. So it's, I mean, they may not be they're not usually that unsafe for most people, but it's like, it's also one of those things where, well, neither is storing cash under your bed nor is using cryptocurrency. And most of the time people have cryptocurrency on their phone, it's not going to be a substantial amount, you know. You know, they're probably gonna have way more, you know, cash in their bank account than they have, or under their bed than they have cryptocurrency on their phone. So yeah, your phone could get hacked into, but it's probably not as big of a deal as you think, or some people think, I should say. I shouldn't say, probably people listening to this show don't think it's that dangerous, but I think some people who are not that tech savvy, you know, think it's dangerous. There's no doubt that, you know, people could lose money, you know, in terms of, you know, your average individual who knows nothing about technology, for one reason or another, either because of incompetence or because, you know, of somebody stealing a piece of malware or not writing down their password for their wallet or whatever. Not that I suggest you write down your password, but at least don't forget your password, basically. All right. So yeah, I think that's about it for the story. It wasn't really anything else I thought was worthy of talking about. So the DailyBeast.com is reporting Judge warns Julian Assange to shut up after shouts of nonsense at extradition hearing. I don't understand when somebody's lying about you on the stand, how you're supposed to just shut up and take it when the government is going to then use that and use violence against you. I just don't understand how you're supposed to just shut up and take it. And I get that you have your turn, right? But they're literally on the stand lying about you and you can't counter them immediately. So then that gets stuck in people's heads. And then when you have an opportunity to like refute it or whatever, you know, you may not really have that opportunity, because if you say something, then they're going to be able to counter question you. And so it's like, it's one of these things where, well, you don't want to incriminate yourself either, so you can't actually refute it, or it's not easy to refute. And it just, the whole thing is just so, the whole system is so messed up. 2 weeks after Senator David Perdue helped to dilute a rule that governed the prepaid debit card industry, he reported acquiring stock in a company that stood to benefit from the rollback of those regulations. What? This is not the story. I am very lost. It's like giving me a different story than what I want to cover. Okay, let's sorry guys, give me a second. Let me see if I can get the right story up and see. I'm in reader mode, but some this reader mode doesn't appear to work for the Daily Beast. So let's get out of reader mode and see if it works. Okay, let's see here. London, in a few weeks or months, Judge Vanessa Barrister will rule on whether Julian Assange can be taken to the United States to face a string of serious espionage charges. So it's probably a good idea for him to stay in her good graces. Yeah, that's probably true. But on Tuesday, the second day of the WikiLeaks founder's extradition hearing in London, which was delayed for months by the coronavirus pandemic, Barrister delivered a forceful warning to Assange that he will be removed from court for good if he can't keep his thoughts to himself while witnesses are delivering their evidence. Assange reportedly shouted out nonsense during the hearing when the lawyer representing the U.S. told a witness that the WikiLeaks founder was facing extradition for handling leaked documents, but for releasing the names and endangering U.S. informants. Wow. I mean, if there wasn't a better excuse or reason for standing up and calling out these liars, I don't know what else is. I mean, seriously, like, for releasing the names and endangering U.S. informants, for one, it didn't endanger anybody. And two, even if it did, that's not the fault of, you know, Julian Assange. That's the fault of the U.S. government. They're the ones who put these people in those situations in the first place. Clearly displeased by his outburst outbursts, and it's also the government's own failing to keep that information secret in the first place. That's the other thing. It's like they put these people in these situations, and then if the information is leaked, it puts them into a greater danger, but it's also still the fault of the government, not the fault of, you know, somebody who received a leaked information that then reports on it. Clearly displeased by his outburst, Barrister told Assange, who was in the dock, that he must not speak out even when he inevitably disagrees with the position of the prosecution team. And the thing is, I've seen this in court, you know, on a number of occasions, and I've heard from other people who have been in court, you know, for similar, or not for similar things, but for other things. And it's often that, you know, police and forensics experts or supposed forensic experts and, you know, FBI agents will get on the stand and they will testify and they will lie or mislead or be incompetent. You know, they'll say things like Bitcoin is anonymous where they'll talk about effectively what Monero or Zcash or something like that. And they'll act as if that's Bitcoin, and it's not. And it's like, they'll say things like, it's Bitcoin and it can't be traced. Well, that's not true. You just lied. You just got up on the stand and you lied about this. It's not, Bitcoin actually can be traced. It's a blockchain. It's not obscured in any way. Now, if you got up on the stand and you said, if you're an expert, if you're claiming to be an expert, and you got up on the stand and you said, well, there's no records of you know, who owns the wallet, well, that would be true for Bitcoin. But it's not true to say that the transactions can't be traced. They absolutely can be traced, and they are traced. And this idea that you get up on the stand and then lie about these things, you know, you're either incompetent or, you know, you're biased, or in your judgment and your testimony should be thrown out, and you probably should be in a jail cell yourself for your what I would say is a crime. Effectively, I think should probably be a crime. You know, you're participating in the use of violence or act of violence against another human being through your supposed expert testimony. So if you interrupt proceedings and disrupt a witness who is properly giving their evidence, it's open to me to continue without you in your absence, Barrister told Assange. This is obviously not something I wish to do. I'm therefore giving you a clear warning. The judge added, I understand you'll hear things you disagree with and you'd like to contradict and speak about these things yourself, but this is not your opportunity to do so. Wow. Yeah. It's just amazing. It's these people have, there's very rarely a penalty for getting up on the stand and lying. You know, perjury. It's perjury, but nonetheless, people do it all the time, and there's rarely a repercussion for it. On the other hand, the people that it's affecting are literally having violence being used against them and being screwed over, you know, by these bad actors. And usually it is some sort of law enforcement agent or supposed expert, when it's somebody working for the government, somebody who is in a position of power. And, you know, power corrupts, you know, as they say. So the warning came after the founder of the legal charity Reprieve, Clive Stafford Smith, told the court that grave violations of law, including the use of U.S. drones for targeted strikes in Pakistan, as well as alleged U.S. war crimes in Afghanistan and Guantanamo Bay, have been exposed in the documents published by WikiLeaks. So the, one of the things here is they're basically saying, well, that's irrelevant. And it's not wrong. It is kind of irrelevant. But, you know, look at what, you know, he's effectively being charged with. He's being charged effectively with revealing information that was already leaked, because it potentially endangered somebody. And the thing is, it wasn't really that which, you know, endangered, you know, these individuals. It was the government's own actions that did the endangerment, not, you know, the furtherance thereof. It's a bit of a stretch to say that it was, you know, Julian Assange, you know, who had endangered anybody. There is certainly lots of, you know, blame to go around. You're already talking about people who are entering dangerous situations. There's a limit to, you know, what you can claim as far as endangerment. You can't say that Julian Assange endangered, you know, these people without saying that the government endangered them to a far greater degree. And you don't see the government on the stand, you know, and being, you know, or the people working for the government, for that matter, you know, being prosecuted for their crimes or for the war crimes in this case that he revealed. And it was even found this last show, I think we covered a story on how Julian Assange, what he revealed, resulted in the U.S. Supreme Court, I believe it was, deciding that the NSA's, I think it was wiretapping, wasn't legal. So it's like, well, hold on a minute. So basically, you know, a lot of what he was revealing was very similar to that. It was illegal. So how is it a crime to reveal something that's illegal? You know, you're in danger, but that's not his fault. You know, you put yourself into that situation. You got involved in that situation. You know, it's a risk you took. You take responsibility for your own freaking risks. It was just the second day of a 4-week hearing at the Old Bailey where the WikiLeaks founder is fighting extradition to the U.S. to face an 18-count indictment on espionage charges. Assange embarrassed the U.S. government a decade ago by publishing thousands upon thousands of confidential American documents. However, Assange's supporters see him as a journalist and champion of free speech, an argument which has been adopted by his lawyers in the early days of the hearing. Yeah, I'm not really an Assange fan. Julian Assange, I kind of a little cringeworthy sometimes, but not because of the bullshit that they've charged him with or attempted to charge him with, or, you know, not any of the sex crime, not supposed sex crimes, not there were, anyway, the point is just that it's just absolutely ridiculous what they're trying to accuse him of. The U.S. charges against Assange carry a maximum sentence of 175 years in prison. Yikes. All right. So that's the end of that story. That's as much as I'm going to say anyway. All right. Well, what else is there? What else do we got? So, the Pirate Bay. TorrentFreak.com reports, expert appears to be to reconsider existence of VPN provider logs, a Torrent Freak reports. And there's actually more to this. There's a ruling, and I don't actually have the ruling, but I will cover the story a little bit, and then I will tell you what the outcome was. Back in June, movie companies Svevzik Film Industry and Nordic Film, supported by Anti-Piracy Partner Rights Alliance, began legal action to try and pick up a trail on the Pirate Bay. In an effort to get closer to the location of the site and then presumably its operators, Rights Alliance filed requests with Cloudflare and subsequently filed a lawsuit in Sweden against VPN provider OVPN. According to the Rights Alliance, the Pirate Bay had used OVPN to shield its location and the company should therefore have useful information to share. The case has taken multiple twists and turns since, but on the whole, a successful outcome in the case appears to have been leaning in favor of OVPN, which insists that it has a no logs provider, it has been is nothing useful to hand over. The testimony from the expert, basically on the side of the copyright cartel here, basically said, you know, that there was likely some sort of information that OVPN had. Now, what's interesting is he then goes online later after the fact and says, oh, but not in this case. And I think that's kind of humorous. And that's after apparently he got more information, I guess, or something to that effect. You know, they pointed out that, like, oh, yeah, but they've already testified to the fact that that's not how they do things. And countered all of this guy's testimony. And this, I think that was before he testified to it. So it's like they basically got him to testify to something that was like, well, it may be the case. Well, yeah, sure, it may be, but they've already testified to the fact that it wasn't the case. And they're basically trying to manipulate the courts into, you know, into, I don't even know what, into ordering them to reveal something that they don't have, which they would never have been able to have done because they didn't have it. And then I guess maybe they were going to try and hold the OVPN provider liable, you know, for, I guess, refusing to, you know, reveal something they didn't actually have. OVPN should thus be able to search its VPN servers for the given IP address, or alternatively search in their user databases or in backups of these to locate a given user or identity, the opinion read. That's assuming a lot. And I think they stated that they don't keep backups for more than 3 days or something like that. And by the time the subpoena would already reach them, it had already been destroyed, the backup. And there was all these reasons. And they said they fully admitted that, yes, it would have been possible if it had come in, you know, while it was in use, that IP address, they could have revealed something, and they would have, but it didn't. Therefore, they can't. And so it was pretty bad. So the court did end up ruling in favor of OVPN, and that's basically where it ended. So there is no more to this case at this point. And OVPN came out successful in this case, and so I am very much a fan of OVPN and how they managed to pull this off and do things, and their insurance that they have, and not that it should have been or would have been necessary, and it wouldn't have affected users whether or not they had insurance or not, other than maybe they would have been dragged into court and would have had to have paid their lawyers for those cases. But you know, the fact that they had insurance ensured that they weren't just gonna submit, you know, to the demands. Not that they could have in this case, but like I don't know, like I guess I'm thinking like a case where maybe, you know, they did have the information, they would have had lawyers there, and they would have then, we know they would have sent those lawyers, even if they could have more easily just submitted the information that was asked for. So it's good, like, operational security, what they've got, I think. And so I think if there is a VPN provider that is, you know, worthy of considering as in the list of VPN providers, you know, OVPN is probably at the top of the list. Based on, you know, what we can see, what we can perceive from the outside, based on this court case. And they're not the only one who has had a similar, I don't want to say exactly the same setup, but like they've also, you know, they've also done good and in court. I'm trying to think of the name of Private Internet Access had a similar situation, although I don't think they had, in that case, I don't think they had, or a couple of cases actually, I don't think they had insurance, but they did send their lawyers or whoever and had people testify to the fact that they didn't have the logs, which is always a good sign, because not all VPN providers, you know, are to that level of protection as far as privacy is concerned. I have a hard time imagining that any VPN provider is not going to provide some level of protection against, you know, the copyright cartels. But certainly when you have cases, you know, where they are testifying to the fact that they literally can't provide the information because they don't have it, is a pretty good sign, because effectively these people are committing perjury if that wasn't true. So it kind of suggests that it may even be the case that if you need a greater degree of privacy, you know, and you're not just doing something that's, you know, an infringement, you know, some sort of a copyright infringement or being involved in copyright infringement type cases, you know, there may be some level of protection there too, because, you know, if they don't have it, not only can the copyright cartels not obtain the information, but neither can police or law enforcement or whatever, unless of course they're fast enough at, you know, requesting it. And it's like they're in the middle of an investigation, a live investigation. They go to the court same day. Maybe they get an approval for a subpoena and they send it off right away. then maybe, you know, you're not going to be protected. But if you are, on for, you know, 4 hours of VPN connection, do your whatever, and then you disconnect, chances are that they're going to get a warrant, or they're going to get a subpoena. You know, law enforcement's going to get a subpoena, and the VPN provider is going to have enough time to respond before you disconnect, and that log disappears. Is pretty low. Usually, I mean, there are things called like live forensics, and you know, usually you would power off a computer, and then you know, the computer would be seized and taken, and then the forensics would investigate it later, and that would be forensics, really. But there's this thing called live forensics, and it's not a good thing. It's actually a really bad thing. Forensics, period, I think is a bit of a computer forensics anyway, is a bit of a scam. But the problem with live forensics is that it compromises the evidence. It compromises the forensics, because as soon as you start playing with something, you start sticking stuff into that computer, you affect what's going on. You affect what's in memory. And so, you know, live forensics, but live forensics is sort of a similar type of, you know, thing, where it's not something that's likely to be used very often. Certainly, I'm sure it's being used more now in like cases, like, for example, I'm trying to think of not the Pirate Bay, Silk Road, the original Silk Road. They certainly did a live forensics investigation on that when they seized his computer. Okay. But chances are, you know, if you're a low-level drug dealer selling on the Silk Road, they probably didn't do a live forensics investigation on the computer when they seized it, when they raided your house. They probably pulled the power and, you know, sent that off to a computer forensics investigator. If that computer had been encrypted, you probably would have been okay. If you were not stupid enough to be doing it from a library, chances are you could have pulled the power even, you know, before they actually had the opportunity to seize it. But then again, you have to remember, this is why they plan these things out. In the case of Silk Road, he was in the library. Normally you'd think, okay, well, not a big deal, you know, because, you know, he could just pull the power too. But the problem is that they plan these things, so you're not going to be expecting it. And what initially appears to be the case, as is what they did for Ross Ulbricht, was they basically had two people arguing that didn't look like police or whatever, and distracted Ross. And in the process of distracting Ross, he backs away from the computer, didn't pull the plug, doesn't realize it's government, doesn't realize it's FBI or law enforcement, doesn't pull the plug because he doesn't realize the threat. And this is why anytime somebody is, you know, there's noise or there's a disturbance, you need to pull the plug. You need to pull that plug, because otherwise, if it turns out that even though it just seems like it's two people arguing in a library and you need to back away from the fighting, you got to pull that plug while you're backing away from that fighting. Because otherwise, if it does turn out to be law enforcement, you know, you could get screwed over because of, you know, obviously unjust laws. In the case of the Silk Road, no violence, no crime. Is what I believe anyway. These were a response to statements made in earlier Technical Opinion suggesting that backups, if they exist, would be useful, but they didn't exist. All right, let's see here. So we got one last story. Before I get into the next story, I'm just gonna. I always like to give out a coupon code for listeners of the show, kind of as a thank you and as a marketing tool promotion of thinkpenguin.com. thinkpenguin.com, sponsor of the show. I'm the CEO of thinkpenguin.com and founder. The coupon code is RMS, all caps. That will give you a 3% discount off any kind of computers or merchandise that you might buy at thinkpenguin.com. Laptops, desktops, printers, Wi-Fi cards, CV tuners, dial-up modems, wireless routers, mini VPN routers, you know, pretty much anything, switches, Wi-Fi cards, TV tuners, dial-up. Actually, we don't have TV tuners anymore. Basically any kind of HDMI capture cards. So any kind of accessory that you might get at thinkpenguin.com, you get 3% off if you use the coupon code RMS, all caps. There's also another coupon code. If you sign up for the thinkpenguin.com mailing list, just go to thinkpenguin.com, click on the mailing list. You'll get another coupon code in the email after signing up. You can combine those emails. That's a 2% discount. This is a 3%. You add the two together, that's 5% discount. There is another coupon code you can get as well that can be added to this. And that, in order to get that, you have to send an encrypted email to chris@thinkpenguin.com, and you will get a response with a coupon code, another coupon code for another 2% discount. And that's obviously to promote, you know, use of encryption and so on, because we like encryption on this show. We like decentralization. We like, you know, we like all of those things, you know, privacy, freedom. And so that's just a little way of encouraging people to pick up some GPG, start print it on your business cards, you know, do whatever you can. And I get a surprising amount of encrypted email. So it's, you know, it works. You need to have people using encryption that are not doing bad things in order to protect people. And I shouldn't say bad things. Bad things is not the right word. You need people not doing non-illegal things to protect people who are doing the illegal things. And illegal things can be things that are morally correct, right? So maybe you are, I don't know, in a dictatorship and, you know, the government's doing bad things, right, to people, and you are a dissident and you want to arrange a coup. Well, how do you do that? I mean, obviously a dictatorship is a little bit of a difficult situation already because it will probably just kill you if you are using encryption at all. But hey, you got to make it as difficult as for them as possible. So maybe you're not in a dictatorship, but you're in a pseudo dictatorship. Maybe you're under a tyrannical regime like the United States. I don't know. I'm just saying maybe it's not as bad as some dictatorships, but you are still a dissident, you know, situations like that. And if you want to be able to blend into the crowd, you know, and protect these sorts of people, you also have to sometimes protect bad people. You have to sometimes, actually bad people, like the police, for example. The police use Tor. That's a great example. And if you want to protect the people who are doing, you know, morally correct things and so forth, and well, you got to let the bad people in too, i.e. police. So yeah, and that's why I would encourage people to use encryption, even though it may not have any real usefulness from in your life. I certainly doubt I've ever sent an encrypted email that was something I needed to keep secret or important or protect myself from government. But that's not the point. The point is simply that when the time comes and you need protection, you need to be able to blend in. And you may never need it, but if you don't, well, that's probably a good thing. But if you do, it could mean the difference between life and death. So yeah. I'm trying to think if there's anything else. Oh, if you spend cryptocurrency at thinkpenguin.com, so Bitcoin or Bitcoin Cash, although we'll also accept other cryptocurrencies, but you got to send us an email, basically. Bitcoin and Bitcoin Cash are accepted automatically through the website. So if you use cryptocurrency, you can also get another discount. A discount, I believe. Oh, it's not a discount like a percentage. It's a free shipping offer, basically, if you use cryptocurrency. And these are all things that apply to people in the United States. I believe the coupon codes we accept for people outside the United States too, just not the free shipping offer. There are some restrictions on that. I think the restrictions are it doesn't apply to printers and scanners, I believe, are the two exceptions. And I think that's just the discounts, not the free. No, it's the free shipping that doesn't apply, I think, is what it is. And although I don't know why I don't think we would exclude computers. I think it would only be the printers and scanners is what we'd exclude. Yeah, printers and scanners is what we exclude. So there you go. All right, let's get back to the show here. We're almost done. So this is TornFreak.com reports Copyright Alliance again urges Congress to close streaming piracy loophole. Oh boy, this is definitely a censorship story. Last month, entertainment industry-backed group Digital Citizens Alliance. You know, I love how they say Digital Citizens Alliance, even though it's like basically just a lobbyist group for the copyright cartels. Digital Citizens Alliance and content protection company Negra published a new study that estimated the pirate IPT market to be worth $1 billion each year in the U.S. alone. I love a piece of action in that. These types of piracy studies are nothing new, but what is interesting about this particular market is that even the biggest pirate U.S. players, if they take caution in what type of content they offer and how, are unlikely to find themselves on the wrong end of an aggressive criminal prosecution. What? These types of piracy studies are nothing new, but what is interesting about this particular market is that even the biggest pirate US players, if they take caution in what type of content they offer and how, are unlikely to find themselves on the wrong end of an aggressive criminal prosecution. Okay. I'm not sure if they said that what they meant there, but were very, very confusing words. Wordy, very wordy. There are caveats and exclusions, but in general terms, streaming piracy is not a felony in the United States. Oh, okay. I think I understand what they're saying. So they're saying that basically they're not likely to be prosecuted because it's not a crime. It's not a serious crime in the United States to stream content. It is to offer downloads of that content, though. So that's what the streaming loophole is. That such a loophole exists in the United States under, and it's not that it's not a crime to stream content, it's a crime to stream content, it's just a misdemeanor as opposed to a felony. That such a loophole exists in the United States under what many believe are some of the most strict copyright laws in the world is a surprise in itself. But exists it does, and here's how it came to be. Under the existing criminal copyright laws, felony penalties are only available for infringements that breach the exclusive rights of reproduction and distribution. Unlawful copying of content and distribution to others. In many cases, however, streaming is viewed as infringing public performance rights, which is considered a misdemeanor. The end result is that regardless of the scale of a pirate streaming operation and how much revenue is generated by it, the hands of the authorities are effectively tied in respect of offenses that would otherwise attract years in prison. Yeah, this is, I'm trying to think of the guy, and I'm pretty sure we covered stories from him, but he basically ran an IPTV business, and he basically said it's not a crime, and it's like they seized his cars and all sorts of stuff, and it's a crime, it's a misdemeanor, but a misdemeanor is not a significant crime relative to like a felony. So I don't know exactly what defines a misdemeanor, presumably at the federal level, is it's copyright, but I know like in New Hampshire, for example, a misdemeanor is I think up to a year in jail basically, and if more than a year in jail is considered to be a felony. And then there's a class A and a class B misdemeanor in New Hampshire, so I'm not sure I recall what the difference was between a class A and class B misdemeanor in New Hampshire. But anyway, one is definitely up to a year in prison, I think. And then the other, I'm trying to think what would be the consequence to the other. Like, if it's not up to a year, then I don't know. I'm not sure. I can't remember. I faced it in New Hampshire myself, and they dropped the case against me, and then I sued them. And won, by the way. I sued them. They basically made up shit and that wasn't true. And then were like, well, it's on video. How stupid do you get? And not only is it on video, but it's on multiple videos. So you can't just destroy a video that you came from my camera because there's another video of it that was recorded by yet another person. And the guy even perjured himself in his sworn statement of what happened as well, and it's like on video, so it's like, yeah, the guy, I mean, this is what I'm talking about. Like these bad cops, they never get fired. It doesn't matter if you have evidence against them, nothing will ever happen. It doesn't matter if you file a complaint, and I'm not saying that nothing happens if you file a complaint. Yeah, it can affect them, but it's insignificant, you know, in the scheme of things. You know, some of these crimes are, you know, these are, I don't want to say people should be executed for them, but these are execution level offenses in my mind. You know, when you kill somebody, you damn well better have been, being attacked, and you better not have started started it in the first place. And if you went up to somebody and then they attack you, yeah, you're the one in the wrong. You're the one who initiated the violence, law enforcement, not the other person. You went up to them. You were a threat to them. They attacked you because you were threatening them. All right. Now, maybe they had some reason to attack you, but you're still a threat to them, and they're still justified probably in defending themselves. in my mind. Exceptions exist. It's not a complete free-for-all. As ongoing cases against Mega Upload and Jetflix demonstrate, streaming offenses can sometimes enter the criminal realm. While some streaming services exploit the loophole cited above, others can face criminal charges when they are deemed to have breached reproduction and distribution rights by copying infringing content and distributing it to others. Also, as highlighted by the Department of Justice in a letter to the Senate last year, criminal prosecutions may also follow when unlicensed streaming operations are alleged to have committed other crimes, such as money laundering and racketeering. Yeah, I mean, this is the money laundering is like a catch-all offense. It's ridiculous. It's like, you know, you've committed crime. If you're accused of committing one crime, well, even if you haven't committed that crime, they'll charge you with money laundering because, like, that's the definition of money laundering. So you might get off on the other crime and then still get convicted of money laundering somehow, though. And it's just ridiculous. Money laundering and racketeering charges, and that's just because the system is so fucked up. Charges also being faced by Kim.com and his Mega Upload co-defendants. Pressure building to close the loophole. In an opinion piece published in The Hill yesterday, Keith, I'm not even going to try to pronounce that last name, but it's something like Cupper, I guess I am, Cupper Schmid, chief of powerful industry group Copyright Alliance, again raised the issue of the loophole, echoing the sentiments of law enforcement groups, entertainment companies, filmmakers, and sports groups that have contributed to the debate thus far. He urged Congress to ensure that, notice how no, like, individuals, no people, the public, nobody in the public interest has allowed in this debate. He urged Congress to ensure that in appropriate large-scale commercial cases, felony penalties are available to federal prosecutors. Screw that. Virtually every significant, you have the right to attempt to profit off your work. You do not have the right to profit off that work. If the public does not want to pay you for that work, there is nothing in law. The government should not be able to use violence to ensure that the public, or to steal money from the public or from individuals to ensure that you are financially stable or can be profitable at what you do. Virtually every significant form of willful commercial piracy can be prosecuted as a felony under appropriate circumstances, including copying CDs, illegal file sharing, and even cam ripping movies in the theater, he wrote. But unlike all of those, streaming piracy, the whole concept of copyright is one big fraud on the people, on the public. It's so disgusting what they're saying here. But unlike all of these, streaming piracy, no matter how widespread or organized, and regardless of the amount of damage done, can only be prosecuted as a misdemeanor, and simply because when the laws were drafted, streaming video wasn't an option. Indeed, the laws that currently limit felony penalties to infringements involving reproduction and distribution were put in place almost 3 decades ago. At the time, widespread internet use wasn't yet a thing, and the possibility of streaming movies or TV shows to the public was a distant dream. Yeah, but you could still do a performance and infringe copyright, or I don't know if that's the right word, but infringe publicity rights of I think that's the terms that they would use anyway. The publicity rights, and the real difference is that you probably couldn't do it as easily on as large of a scale. So I mean, we're literally talking about a level of scale here. Congress working hard to close the loophole. Fortunately, Congress is working hard to solve this problem. Yeah, whatever. I don't really care. Blah, blah, blah. The resulting proposal is a consensus product with broad-based support. I'm pretty sure it's not a consensus because I'm pretty sure the people who are committing the copy, streaming offenses already would not agree with you, and neither do many other people out there who don't believe in copyright in the first place. Now, you've brainwashed a lot of people into the concept of copyright, but that doesn't mean everybody has. And there are plenty of public interest groups that are also going to be opposed to this. It is narrow. So clearly you're excluding people of certain opinion from, this supposed consensus. All right. It is narrowly tailored to address the serious problem of commercial streaming piracy, ensuring ordinary internet users, legitimate businesses, and non-commercial actors have nothing to fear from the proposal. The mention of ordinary internet users remaining unaffected by these proposals is of interest. Well, of course it's going to affect ordinary internet users, because people who don't want to install proprietary software are going to be excluded from having access for all effective purposes, or all intensive purposes, or something like that, you know, from having access to this content now. I mean, theoretically, if it was actually effective, which it won't be, but anyway, the last time a bill was presented to amend the relevant sections of law, I'm not going to read that, to render criminal breaches of the public performance rights punishable as felonies, things didn't go well for copyright holders. Right. So basically, they're trying to bring back, let's see here, what is the name of that act? SOPA, I think it was. So yeah, they're basically trying to bring back SOPA again. So if you were against that, you should be against this as well. And there was major outrage over that. Yeah, Stop Online Piracy Act, which was SOPA. It never passed due to unprecedented public outcry. Yeah, not a done deal, but momentum is building. While the companies that rely on streaming and physical product sales are desperate for a streaming loophole to be well and truly closed, this time around, they will not have to contend with the scale of the uproar that accompanied the far-reaching SOPA bill. Maybe, maybe not. I mean, people, unfortunately, you know, they're not paid. You know, the entertainment industry is effectively benefits from this bill being passed. Who benefits, you know, substantially or to the same degree from the bill not passing? And the reality is that, you know, the people who stepped up in support of SOPA originally and led the charge against SOPA, they have limited resources. They have limited energies. They may not have the energy to do the same thing all over again. That doesn't mean, you know, and that's a sad thing. That's a sad part about this whole thing is, you know, the right thing doesn't usually happen. Most laws are, it's the opposite of whatever the law says. That is the moral thing. That's the right thing. And it's usually somebody benefiting, whether it be even regulations, oftentimes, are to the benefit of the established industry, because what those regulations do is they keep out smaller competitors from entering their industry and eating their market once those industries have started. Now, sure, it's often the case that, you know, industries that initially, new industries, don't want regulations, but over time, often they do want regulations, so because it benefits them, so they end up getting people like supporting the regulations, and they will come out and as if like they're doing the right thing by passing, you know, getting the government to pass regulations. And it just, it's always blows my mind, you know. Regulations are not generally a good thing. They're usually a bad thing. They usually hamper competition, and that's not a good thing. You know, it's, people are easily blinded. So, indeed, there seems to be optimism that Congress will see fit to accept the proposals, which, according to Kupershinid, are being formed with the assistance of tech companies, not potentially at their expense, as per last time around. Yeah, okay, whatever. Yeah, blah, blah, blah. Close the streaming loophole. Yeah, it's just more bullshit censorship stuff, and I absolutely cannot support it, and would encourage everybody to most of the time your objections to laws don't change anything, you know, even if you have a massive number of people who are up and in arms against them. You know, the Congress will do whatever's in there, what they feel. Congress critters will do whatever they feel is in their best interest. And especially when it comes to these types of matters like copyright, because the industry is they have a huge lobbying, you know, army of lobbyists, the copyright cartels. There's almost zero chance that anything other than this passing is going to happen. If it wasn't for this being particularly bad for internet service providers and hosting companies last time, you know, it probably would have passed last time, but this time they've made some adjustments to these bills, basically is what they're saying, and now those parties won't, the people who have the money won't object to it. So even if the little guy tries to object, it won't matter at this point, because the little guy doesn't have any lobbyists. Congress critters know this, and most people aren't even gonna, even when you have a lot of people who are against it, the lobbyists know, and I'm sorry, the Congress critters know that the most people, they don't need that. Even though it's a large number of people, it's not enough to matter in the scheme of things when it comes to elections and things like that. They'll pass it. I expect that to be what happens, unfortunately. But all right. That is a show. Technically, we didn't actually do 3 hours. We did like closer to 2 hours, but it is over. So I'm out of content and interesting stuff to talk about. So see everybody next week. Have a good weekend.